saw that step, I almost fell. Hi, I'm Bernadette, I'm an addict. I'm really honored to be here. I want to thank the committee for asking me to do this meeting. I feel much more centered. I did a meeting about, I guess about a month and a half ago at another convention, and I felt like so scattered and so afraid. I'm going to give you a little bit about, little information about myself and where I came from and how I lived my life and how I survived living my life and through the lousy choices that I made for myself. I was born a single child of two parents that were addicts. I know in retrospect now that, you know, they did the best that they could do as far as giving me the same things that they were given, which wasn't a whole lot. And, you know, it says in our pamphlet about the self-centered, the triangle of self-obsession, and how we all as children are supposed to be consumed with self. You know, everything is about us. Everything begins and ends with us. And that's how we're supposed to be, you know. I have no memory of a lot of my childhood. There's very few bits and pieces about my childhood that I remember. And today what I know for me is that that was a gift from God, because he allows, I believe, it's been my experience, he allows children to be able to disassociate when things are going on in their lives that they don't know how to handle. So for me, there was a lot of disassociating going on, and I really believe my first drug of choice for me was fantasy. And then my second drug of choice became food, because I lived in a household that was not conducive, as I said, to my safety. And there were some things going on in that household that were very damaging to my spirit. And, of course, had no way of telling, because people weren't going to believe me. That's what I was told. So my safety wasn't real, it wasn't conducive for my recovery, I mean, for being little. So what I did very early on is I started, because I had no skills and being so little, in order to survive, I picked up food very early on. And I used food very differently than all my friends. You know, I would steal it, I would hide it, I would hoard it. The best days were days that would be pouring down rain and both my parents would be out of the house, and I would go and hoard all this food and hide it from who, I don't know, because I was an only child. But that thinking, that not having enough, not being enough, all that that disease and how it manifests itself. I have a learning disability even today. I don't read above a third grade, second grade reading level even today. So I was really little, in school, couldn't read or write, being sexually molested and emotionally abused on a regular basis. So what I did is I hid. I hid out. I ate. I hid out some more, and I ate some more, and that's how I survived a lot of the time. By the time I was, I guess, 8 or 9, my image of myself, you know, by the time I was 9 years old, I had my period. I was wearing a bra, a big girl, you know, supposed to act like I knew what was going on, which I didn't, and scared to death, fear, full of fear, full of anxiety. And once again, couldn't talk to anybody. And of course, I was so consumed with myself and so afraid and had no means and no skills to do anything, everything began and ended with me. I don't know about any of you, but I got stuck. When I crawled into the rooms at 38 years old, beaten and battered, and literally crawled in because I felt so bad about myself. I emotionally probably was 10 or 12, you know, and I was 38, and I was trying to live life on life's terms between using and being so afraid and so consumed with me, you know, everything began and ended with me. So I used, like I said, I started probably when I was around 9. My mother took me to the doctors to get diet pills. And I started on diet pills, and of course, as soon as I started them, you know, back then you get a prescription of 100, and I started immediately abusing them, and it felt really good. I became very smart, very tall, very thin, and could talk to anybody. It made me talk really fast, and I could clean really good. It just gave me that false courage, and I loved it. It made me feel really good. And from that point on, and I always talk about the last piece of my addiction, I was taking probably about 30 pills a day and drinking about a fifth of vodka. The progression of the disease. And along with that, had lost my spirit, or gave it away. You know, I was doing seedy things for seedy reasons, you know. You know, I would work doctors, and I would work pharmacists, and I was a prescription addict. I didn't do street drugs. I think one time I smoked PCP, and I ended up in a motel room with some guy for about 3 days, and everybody's face looked this long. It was awful. And I was much too controlling to do that kind of drug. You know, I had to be, so I thought I was in control. But that made me too afraid, you know, so that wasn't the kind of junkie I was. You know, I worked, like I said, I worked the doctors and the pharmacists and, you know, liquor, and it worked for me. Along the way, I got married at 17, and I was a mother at 19, and I had this kid. Now, imagine someone with the disease of addiction, emotionally totally unavailable, having this kid and not knowing what to do with him. I mean, he's amazing today. I've got 26 years clean. He's got 24 years clean, in spite of our journey. And, I believe we're all on a journey. So I had this kid. I didn't know what to do. And every time something would happen, major in school or just anything, you know, I would just have another drink and go out and just stay because I didn't know what else to do. As I said before, I was frozen in that space, that place, that being totally consumed with myself. And I brought a picture of myself when I was 3 years old. And I was looking at it, you know, when I was asked to do this meeting, because I could never identify with her. I never had any feelings about her, that little girl, that was really innocent and loving and needy and kind and caring. And I want, I need, I want, I need, you know. I really hated her for a very long time. And through the 26 years that I've been in recovery, I have been able to forgive, love, nurture her, tell her everything's okay, learn about unacceptable behavior, learn about not allowing people to misuse or abuse my spirit anymore. I'm really good. I've learned how to do, how to set healthy boundaries here. You know, I've learned, you all gave me the gift of helping me with my self-esteem, because I had none when I got here. When I got married, like I said, at 17, a mother at 19, and then when I was 24 years old, I hit my first nightclub, and it was like wonderful. I mean, I fell in love, and I used for about 19 years altogether. I finally cleaned longer than I did when I was using, you know. And during that time, what I would do is I would use not only drugs, alcohol, food, credit cards, sex, shopping, whatever, you know. When I got clean, I ended up behaving in the same manner. You know, I put down drugs, alcohol, and cigarettes, and I picked up food because I was so afraid, and I had no sense of self. And of course, it was all about me. So what I did at 17, married, divorced, had this kid. I've always worked really hard my whole life. You know, I've been working since I was about 9 years old in order to get my needs met. And, you know, some of us come in here and we process things very differently. Those of us that have been thrown away like trash or treated like we were unworthy or loved and nurtured, you know, and it's how we perceive our lives. The way I processed early on, I got it really quickly that if I wanted whatever it was I needed, I was going to have to go get it. And that is a blessing for me because I have always been able to take care of myself in that way. I've always been a really hard worker, and I've always had great work ethics. And of course, being a hairdresser, and all the hairdressers got high, and that's where I had to go to work in order to get my drugs. I always showed up for work, always. And that was like, it was a cash business. It worked for me. I never missed work. I loved doing what I was doing. And so when I got clean and decided to move out of the salon that I was in and move to another salon where there were people that were not using, you know, I was able to do that. So when I got clean, I put down, like I said, I put down drugs, alcohol, and cigarettes, and because of my fear and my anger and my resentments, because even today with 26 years clean, I can go to, when I get fearful, I can get really ugly. I have a tattoo, tattooed of a monkey on my shoulder. And the reason that I put it there is to remind me that I can strap on that monkey hat and show my red ass and play my tambourines at any point in time if I get fearful, because I'll go from fear to rage because it's safer. It's much safer for me to be angry to keep you away than to say to you, I really need a hug, I'm really scared, I need your love and support. I'm like, fuck you, I don't need anything. And I still will do that. And I have to really be mindful of that if I get afraid. My sponsor told me that I only had one character defect, and that was fear. And that fear will take me anywhere, anytime, around the, you know, wherever it is that I need to be. That fear will do it to me. So I got clean. I had a sponsor in name only. I didn't work any steps because, I knew the name of the unknown soldier. You know how we are when we come in. We know everything. You know, there were a couple things my sponsor told me really early on. You need to say, you need to shut up and sit down and smile and act like you want to be here. Sit up front and just, you don't know anything. Just shut up. Because everything she would say to me, the first thing I would say is, I know. And one day I caught her, I guess she was in a bad mood, and she said to me, you don't know a fucking thing. Sit down and shut up. And I was like, oh. And of course I didn't call her for about 2 or 3 days because my baby feelings were hurt. And she called me back and after about 3 days and said, I know where you live. So, like, why haven't you haven't called, you know? Why haven't you, like, picked up the phone? Where's your humility? You know, where is your willingness to look at yourself? And so I, as I said before, I picked up food. I ended up gaining 100 pounds in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. And because the first addiction was that food that it worked for me. And I don't know about any of you, but because I'm so self-absorbed that I have come into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous and I have done the same things other than not use in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, clean. That's been my story. I've gotten myself in debt twice, over $10,000, and had to borrow the money and pay it all back. Done it twice in 26 years. I gained 100 pounds in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous and came in here and cried and screamed and performed like a circus monkey because I was so out of control about food. And then when I decided at 6 years clean on my sixth step that I was going to do something different, I ended up having my stomach stapled and lost 100 pounds here. So when people meet me or know me today, you know, they don't know where I came from. You know, when I came in the rooms back then, I couldn't look at anybody. You know, I knew what everybody's shoes looked like because I couldn't look you in the face. I couldn't look me in the face. Because I was so beat up and ashamed. And 6 years clean, had my stomach stapled, lost 100 pounds, and it was right around the World Convention in California. It was about 18 years ago. I don't remember the exact date. About 18 years ago. And I flew out to California, first time I'd ever been on a plane, with three of my sponsees, and went to this World Convention. And it was right by Disneyland, and they were out and about and on the beach and were looking real cute, and I had lost probably 70 pounds in the first 4 months of my surgery and couldn't stuff, and I literally thought I was having a nervous breakdown. I mean, when people would come to me around the pool, I peed in the pool. I literally peed in the pool because I could not get up and go to the bathroom because you all were looking at me. Me. How important am I? I mean, this disease is so powerful. It flips me out. And all the girls, they were looking at me like I was crazy because here I had some time. These girls are all brand new. And they're like, what the hell's wrong with you? And it was like, I couldn't even explain what was wrong with me. I didn't know what was wrong with me. All I knew is that I was naked. I felt absolutely naked because I hid behind that rage, that anger, and that fat to keep you all away from me. You know, when you're an incest victim around here, fat worked for me. If I was fat, I kept you away. You know, I wasn't the most attractive. I dressed like I was crazy, like I belonged in Shepherd Pratt. I would do anything at all just to, like, you know, stay away. My rage and anger kept people away. So little bit, learning about this disease, learning how insidious it is and how it'll take everything. You know, it'll take my job, and it'll take my family, and it'll take, you know, everything I own. But it really wants my life. That's what it wants. It wants to isolate me. It wants to keep me quiet. It wants to keep me alone. And it doesn't want me to be happy. And it doesn't want me to live in the light. Because if it can keep me isolated and alone and afraid, then it's got a shot. I am no better off. I don't know about you all. I got up at 7:30 this morning. And if you got up earlier than I did, you got more clean time than I do. And I really live by that. I really believe that the reason that I'm here and have been here as long as I have is because, you know, I don't forget where I came from. And I really try to carry a message of hope. That's what I do in my job. I work for my partner, and we do transitional housing for drug and alcohol clients. And every day, that disease is staring me in the face. Every single day, a newcomer comes out of a treatment center with a day clean. And my job not only affords me the opportunity to carry a message of hope when I go into treatment centers and I go to jails and institutions, and I go, that my job takes me to these places. So the disease is always there, staring me in my face. And my responsibility in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous is to continue to carry a message. And I find it, I'm proud to say that I have a job that I'm able to do that as well, to carry a message to a newcomer, to let them know that your life can be beyond its wildest dreams if you work these 24 principles. If your ego doesn't kill you, you know. So I came in the rooms, I got clean, I had a sponsor in name only, I ate my way through these 24 principles that I knew about, but I wasn't willing to work on them or to look at them. You know, the very first meeting that I went to, and I tell newcomers this all the time, I went to a meeting, and the very first meeting I went to, they said to me, you have a disease of the feelings, and it's what you have the most of and know the least about. And I was like, what the hell are they talking about? You know, I thought I was crazy. And I stuck around, literally, I stuck around long enough to understand exactly what they were talking about. That for me, my disease sits on my shoulder. I have a monkey on this side that's tattooed there permanently, and my disease sits on my other shoulder, and it constantly chatters. It never stops. It's insidious. It tells me the most outrageous things. It has my voice. And today I know when it's my disease, because if it's negative stuff that it's telling me, if it's telling me things that you're not worthy, what in the world are you going to stand at a podium and tell anybody? What message could you possibly give anybody? You know, my life could have been on the Jerry Springer show 3 years ago. I walked out on a 28-year relationship and ended up with a woman. That, because I've always been a lesbian, and I never, ever, ever would look at that. I was with a woman after I left my first husband. I was with her for 4 years, and because of society and because of me not being able to look at me, to take care of me, to be so consumed with me, and you all were going to judge me as if you cared one way or another, my disease told me, you need to run the other way. So I took that piece of me and I stuffed it down, and I lived a lie for 28 years. And then decided one day I was going to take the same advice that I had been giving women for years, and that was to be true to yourself. Don't allow yourself to be beaten up and battered emotionally, physically. Don't allow yourself to be torn apart. So I decided to take my own advice. And I was in a relationship, like I said, for 28 years. And I had some stuff. I had a few things. You know, I had a house. I had a couple houses. And I had a few bucks in the bank. And I went in one day and put my shit in a garbage bag, what little bit of clothes I could put in there, and I rolled out after 28 years. And I have never been happier. I'm with a partner that I absolutely adore. Doesn't mean that we don't have issues. It doesn't mean that we don't have problems. She has the same disease that I do, the disease of self-centeredness. But today, I'm willing to be true to myself. I'm willing to own my behavior. I'm willing to clean up my side of the street. I'm willing to have a power greater than myself. I'm willing to have a sponsor that can tell me anything that I need to hear that'll make the hair stand up on the back of my head and listen to it and be able to change my behavior. So there's a lot of things that I've done on this journey of recovery that I'm really, really grateful for. When I was 43 years old, yeah, my mother went into treatment when I was 43 years old. She had taken like her third overdose. And I always tell this because it was pretty profound. I was 43. I came in when I was 38. And I was the first nighter. I never picked up. I mean, I never found it necessary to use the first time I went to a meeting. I held on, like I said. I didn't work a real good program in the beginning, but then I kept coming back and I didn't use no matter what, because that's what they told me. Don't use no matter what. And that's what I did. And when my mother, I was 43, she ended up taking an overdose. I think it was her third one. And they called me at Mercy Hospital and said, your mother's in intensive care. She's pretty bad off and you need to get here, which I did. And I was at that time volunteering at Shepherd Pratt. Hey girl, I was volunteering at Shepherd Pratt on the alcohol unit. And I called them and said, my mother's in treatment. In the emergency room, and she needs to get into treatment. And can I bring her in? And they said, yeah, but she can't come in until the next day. So I had to bring her home. And I decided to give her a perm that night. She was going to treatment the next day, and I thought, well, it'll make her feel better. I did her nails, did her toes. And as I'm wrapping her hair, giving her this perm, I'm talking to her about recovery, just like I would be talking to anybody, you know. Your secrets will keep you sick. That's what they told me. Give up all your secrets, little bit by little bit by little bit. They'll keep you sick if you don't give them up. And I was talking to her, and I was talking about recovery, and I was talking about giving up your secrets, and I was carrying a message, and all of a sudden she stopped me in midstream and said, I have something I have to tell you. You're probably never going to talk to me again. I said, what? She said, the man that you thought was your father adopted you when you were three. You have a father that's not your father. And what I did, I looked at her and I said, it's time to process your hair. And which I did. I processed her hair and she went and got in the shower and I called my sponsor and I ran it by her and I said, I don't know what to do. Because I had absolutely no feelings about any of that. And I don't know about any of you, but I hear stories and I've been able to tell my story many, many, many times in early recovery and not be attached to the feelings at all. It's like I'm talking about somebody else's life, not mine. And it's been my experience, if you stay around here long enough, eventually you'll get connected with your feelings pertaining to a situation. That's been my experience. So I put it up on my imaginary shelf. The fact that I was adopted, and about 18 months later, I took that down, that from my imaginary shelf, and said, okay, I'm ready to see what's going on. I'm ready to deal with it. And I called a girl that I sponsor because God meets me at all my needs, who was a private detective. And I said, I'm decided that I want to find out who my real father is, and can you help me? And within 2 days, I found out that my father had died, but I had 5 siblings from his other marriage. And through the years, I was able to meet 2 of my brothers. And of course, what came over me was, because my real father had spent time with those kids, but I wasn't good enough. You know, what happened? What was wrong with me? That why didn't he want me?
That's where the disease goes, you know. And through working these spiritual principles and understanding about recovery and understanding that he was as wounded and as sick, and he had died at 49 years old as a direct result of this disease, that someone came and told me that he used to carry my picture around. And when I called the brother and said, this is probably a crazy phone call for you, but I think I'm related to you, he said, Bernadette, they all knew about me because my father would carry my picture around and say, this is the little girl I had to give away. So, I don't know about any of you, but things are presented to us in God's time, not our time. Thanks for having me. I'm finished.
Second speaker today is Walston from the Central Maryland area.
I'm an addict named Walston. Wait a minute, let me speak over here. I'm an addict named Walston.
Hi, Walston.
God. I was feeling like I was hearing in monotone, and I want stereo. If you're not laughing in here and having fun, something's wrong. It's like sex, you ain't doing it right.
Amen.
You know, I want to thank Bernadette for sharing. I want to thank the committee for asking me to pitch in and do this workshop. Somebody stopped me out in the hall and asked me if I was nervous. I was trying to get to the bathroom. And I said, well, I don't think I am. And they held me and they restrained me from getting to the bathroom. Am I nervous? And so I ran to the bathroom and I went in and there was a lady standing there. Oops. I'm sorry. So just thought I'd share that with you guys because it's really an honor. It's really a privilege to have the opportunity to kind of share my journey to this point. And it's been a very interesting and rewarding journey. I could have never dreamt my life would be like this once I got clean and once I got to Narcotics Anonymous, but I'm eternally grateful. Sometimes people see in me a lot more than I see in myself. And I think that's what Bernadette was conveying, that God has the plan, and it's up to me to kind of get in the plan. Because I was always out of the plan. It was never all right with me. And so when we talk about a triangle of self-obsession, it's very easy to kind of get to a place of understanding that the obsession with self was born out of the fact that I wasn't all right with self. I mean, first of all, who's ever heard of a dope fiend named Walston? You know, I mean, from the word go, Walston presented me with a big, she talked about her first drug being fantasy. Well, my first drug, too, was fantasy. And I took that fantasy to a place of, rather than be Walston Barber, I became Jonathan Paris Lovejoy. It just sounded like an image of whoever I wanted to be. And I took that little boy at 12 and put some dark shades on him. And I started walking around in that life for the next 25 years. And in that 25-year journey, what I put on top of Jonathan Paris Lovejoy was defects of character, and then narcotics, and then more defects of character. And I became, in the process, a walking animal. And so being obsessed with self took a back seat to being obsessed with anything that made me feel good. And in the beginning, what made me feel most good was, and excuse me if that's grammatically incorrect, but I often talk about it gets gooder in here, so, you know. And that's where the master's degree. But anyway, in the beginning, what made me feel best was anger. I remember in the third grade, for no apparent reason, and some of my childhood, too, is very vague, but I remember these particular lowlights. And I remember my father would always holler at me for whatever reason. Just holler. He was an alcoholic. I'm named after my father, who died tragically, by the way. And I remember that he would beat my mother. And I remember the feelings and the anger and the resentment I would get from not being able to protect my beautiful mother, who I had these mixed emotions around, because she would fix me these pancakes in preparation for me to go to school, and she'd be in her slip, and I'd be looking at her cleavage and trying to understand why I was feeling these mixed emotions. I'm talking about a little boy confused with life. And so in the third grade one day, when I'm walking along the school, in the school line, along the school, in this line with these boys, and I got the volleyball, for whatever reason, I decided to smash this boy in the head with the volleyball, and he hit his face on the side of the brick wall. I'm talking about anger, rage, uncontrollable rage that got me put out of school 3 times that year. You know, and not understanding why I had this rage, but in retrospect, getting here, being able to see what it was connected to. So by the time someone handed me what we call in Washington buck action, oh man, this was the answer. Somebody can relate. If you don't relate to buck action, call it what you want to call it. I'm talking about getting something that became, for this addict, the panacea, the magic elixir to all the low self-esteem, all of the insecurities. I'm talking about vowing I had to have it at all costs and doing whatever I needed to get it. And began to use that stuff and use that stuff and perpetuate the animal in a way where anger took a back seat to being obsessed with narcotics. And my sponsor started helping me later on, understanding that when the obsession hit, if I don't cancel that reservation, if I don't some way interrupt that obsessive thinking, that when the opportunity presents itself, the compulsion, when it show up, will come out, the irresistible urge to commit the irrational act, and I won't have any defense against it. So I used for a long time against my will. You know, in the beginning it was fun, but somewhere along the line, I crossed that invisible line. I wanted to stop, but I couldn't stop. You know, I remember going, you know, people would say things like, well, Austin, you got a lot of potential. I didn't feel that. You know, she spoke about us having a feeling disease. Well, I'm so glad that my sponsor told me early in my process, fuck your feelings. You see, because that's how I live my life, based on the way I feel. But thank God for this program, because I'm living a program that tells me I need to practice a program in spite of the way I feel or because of the way I feel. But I didn't know that when I was caught up in the disease of addiction, because when the disease said I need to get one, I answered the call at any expense. So I went on through life with all this potential and became this guy that walked around in the end. My last 3 years of addiction, I was walking around the streets of D.C. With 3 teeth. I know you can see me from here. It's my N.A. grill. I remember, I digress. I remember early on when I was in my first meeting, a lady was doing this, and she shared about her teeth, her N.A. grill, and I was sitting in the back with my 3 teeth. I said, that bitch talking about me. She was telling her story. So if you're in here and your grill ain't right, I'm telling my story. You can get your grill right too in here. So, I went on through life, man, trying to get out of this thing, trying to get out, and I'm clear what the grace is, because the grace intervened. I wanted to stop, couldn't stop. I had been introduced to y'all 8 years prior to my last, what I hope was my last arrest. And I got in that institution, and I was in that institution, and the young boys was beating on the tables and stuff, telling me, Slim, don't fuck with that TV. I was like, who they talking to? Talking to your ass. And it became clear to me that I needed to do something about my life because I had used for as long as they had been in the world. I had children their age, and if I didn't do something about my life, I was going to die like that. Hence, me getting in touch with the triangle of self-obsession. I made a decision that this sounded like a good time to go to treatment. I'm on 3CF in the jail. They got a treatment program downstairs. Now, I never do anything without help. And so when they locked down in the jail, in the treatment program, when they lock down, you can come out your cell. Sound like a good thing to do. See, I don't do the spiritual stuff just because it's the right thing to do. I don't know about some of y'all, but I'm telling you, I've always needed extra help with doing the right thing. But I've done it long enough now. See, it's like I did wrong so long, doing right seemed wrong in the beginning. But I've done right long enough now that doing wrong seems wrong. I mean, if you feel, just kind of nod like that every now and then if you kind of get in touch with what I'm saying. Let me know I'm in the right place. Thank you very much. See, so I went downstairs in that treatment program, and this addict here was the kind of addict, the insecure little boy was the kind of addict early on that would go home and mug in the mirror at himself. I can't even do that shit no more. You know, because I wasn't all right with me, and the scared little boy wanted to keep you off of me. And so when I got in that treatment program, they started helping me with not gritting. I had no social skills. I sold slum jewelry on the streets of Washington, D.C. for the last 3 years. I'd grind all day, shoot dope, smoke coke, drink vodka, and then when I see my wife at the end of the day who picked me up and enabled me, I'd peel off $20 and put that in her hand and say, baby, put this up. I'm wearing 155 with three teeth, y'all, three shades dark. What I'm trying to describe to y'all is what it was like. But when I got in that jail, I was just right for Narcotics Anonymous. The triangle needed to be broken. You know, I didn't have a lot of time to prepare for this workshop, but I believe in Webster's because my sponsor early on pointed me in that direction. When I left that jail, I got in touch with the need to have a tool guide in this program. Y'all told me that. In that jail, they told me that. So when I got out, I got a guy, and he started telling me that meetings alone wasn't enough for an addict like me. He said, you need to go come to my home for step study. And I started showing up at his home with these other guys. The we concept took on effect early on. And so he told me in the beginning, he said, you need all your literature, your basic text, your works, how and why. The flat book wasn't out at that time. But he also instructed me to get a dictionary and a highlighter. And so when I was asked to do this workshop, it just occurred to me that I might want to look in a dictionary. And I said, well, what the hell are you going to look for? Because I know what obsession is. I know what self is. And I've tried to describe y'all how consumed I was with me. So I thought about the word triangle, and Webster said some things about a situation, especially an emotional relationship involving three. I'm going to leave that right there. Y'all ponder that one. So that wasn't enough for me because I never get enough. I'm an addict. So I went to that was the Oxford Dictionary. So then I went to the New Collegian Dictionary, and it said a situation involving three persons as when one person is having love affairs with two others. Resentment, anger, and fear. Oh, the sponsor said when I got to six that all of my defects of character, at the root of them, was fear. So I get to this program, and I begin to understand why we base our thing on love. Because I've been operating out of fear for so long. See, I'm the little boy that it was always fuck everything and run. Y'all told me to face everything and recover. Oh, it's good news to know that when I'm fearful, what I really need to do is invite the Creator in, because I'm always so absent from the Creator. Our pamphlet talks about, and I think Bernadette touched on it, about when we were little kids, we were supposed to be brought up a certain way, feeling like we could become self-sufficient. But as addicts, I took my self-sufficiency to another level of, I need more. It's always about more. I never have enough of anything. It says, we became self-obsessed, our wants and needs become demands. We reach a point where contentment and fulfillment are impossible. People, places, and things cannot possibly fill the emptiness inside of us, and we react to them with resentment, anger, and fear. Self-obsession is at the heart of our insanity. It's good news to know that the disease of addiction was centered in my thinking, and if I didn't change my thinking, I was going to keep acting the way I was acting. You know, I remember when the wife I just told y'all would come to pick me up and I would give her those $20. Well, I remember when she said, honey, and this was after 13 years and three children, she said, we can't make it no longer. I was like, what? Me? You can't quit me. Somebody can identify with what I'm saying there. Because I'm talking about being consumed with self and somebody telling you that you're no longer good for them. How dare you? But she had found the works. But you was using too. No, we through. Man, I was delivering freight at the National Airport at this time, and I was already using, but I took this addiction to another level at this time. I'm talking about anger, resentment, and fear turned inwards means depression. It means more using. It means, I'm talking about a fast forward to recovery, because the grace intervened and did for me what I wasn't able to do for myself. And I'm so grateful for everything I went through, because I had to go through that stuff to become the person I'm becoming today. See, this thing is in divine order, y'all. But I get in this program and I forget that what got me here was some power greater than me. If I don't try to connect to that power, I will find myself one more time caught up in my own thinking, which is diseased. See, I can't listen to my own interpretation of stuff. I got to invite somebody in. I got to keep trying to practice something that I fall far short of getting, and that's some humility. Because that's the way for a self-centered, arrogant addict like me to become the character that God can use. See, it's like overwhelming to be even asked to do something like this. I feel less than appropriate for stuff like this. But he ain't asked me if I wanted to do this. He said, I saved you because I got something for you to do. Somebody need to hear that you was caught up in the grips and couldn't stop. You ever been in an oil joint and couldn't stop? Couldn't stop oiling? Couldn't? Somebody in here smoke crack. How about they're getting ready to come and they're going to need your stem? I mean, come on now. Y'all got to help me out here a little bit. I'm talking about caught up in the grips. You want to stop and can't stop. And then they're going to ask me to come stand up on a stage and act like you know something. What I know is I didn't get me here. What I know today is that I've learned enough to know that it's the things I don't know that help me the most. See, I had to get involved in a process that taught me that anything to bring me to my knees is good. Yeah, and as a result of that, man, I'm in touch with understanding today that everything works to the good. Everything. You know, I even accept today obstacles as an opportunity for getting better. I never saw that before I got to this program. I'm the little guy that didn't graduate from high school, and guess what? I can stand here today and tell y'all that I'm working on new goals. I've been able, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, to get my master's degree. Now I'm working on becoming licensed. And I don't say that to boast. I say that because somebody in here needs to hear that that's what we're doing here. I got new goals. Then sold homes, got all my children in my life that love me, got people that kind of look up to me for stuff that I kind of wonder, why are they looking at me for it? Because it ain't about me, it's about my story. It's about where I was and where God then brought me. And if I get caught back up in that triangle of me, myself, and I. One more time, obsession. Let me share this thing with y'all about what's been going on with me lately. They told me I had a pituitary brain tumor last April. And the tumor caused me to have an increased prolactin level. What the hell is that, Walston? Well, a prolactin level is what produces breast milk in ladies. I thought I'd get a little snicker. Well, when they told me that, I didn't snicker. It wasn't funny. But what it also does is decrease the testosterone level. Mm-hmm. So they told me it was benign. That was good news. And they told me it could be treated with a small pill. So I've been taking this pill now for almost a year. But within about 3-4 months, guess what? They were telling me that the prolactin level was subsiding. They didn't have to tell me because the testosterone level has started to increase. Ask me how I know. I knew somebody was going to ask me. Narcotics Anonymous offers only one promise, and that is freedom from active addiction. The solution that eluded us for so long, we will be freed from our self-made prisons. I got a prison right now that's been haunting me, y'all, because I've been looking around at people, and I'm talking about female people. And I love my wife. 15, 16 years I've been loving my wife. I ain't shot no dope in 16 years, and I ain't been outside my relationship in 16 years. But lately, with this increased testosterone, See, you can't be caught up in yourself and still be able to get some awareness of what you're working with. See, I'm living better than I ever lived before. I'm talking about getting free like dancing like nobody's watching free. And so I got a keen awareness of what's going on with this individual standing before you. And I know it's about my body chemistry. And tomorrow, God willing, I'll be 58 years old. And I am so grateful to be able to stand here and tell you all that. But if I don't keep using these podiums to expose me and think I know something, or I got the answer to some cancer or something, then all that old stuff that I'm dealing with right now will become a reality. And just like a hit of crap or a shot of dope, I'll be wondering, why the hell did I do that for? Oh, yeah. I mean, if you can't laugh in here, goddammit, then something wrong. If I couldn't have me some fun in here, I'd leave. So, you know, I use this podium for exactly what it was intended for, to get free. I got a program, y'all. Don't nobody have to tell me. My sponsor said a program is a plan of action. And he said, if you ain't got it written on paper, it's an idea. He said, a plan of action means that you are performing proper preparation, which prevents, I added this one, piss poor performance. He told me a little stuff like, a good soldier prepares for war in a time of peace. See, we real peaceful in there, but check it out, just like the duck going across the water, you know, we working, man. At least I'm working. I'm constantly working at not being so obsessed with me. When the anger raises up, I got to remember my 10th step, because the first thing I need to do is bridle my tongue. That is, I need to be quiet. You know, my expectations are so high. I set standards for people that I can't even reach. Y'all told me that I got to bring to a relationship what I want out of a relationship. Oh, this program is about giving something, y'all. It ain't about taking. I took all my life. I took. And I'm so grateful I got an opportunity today to give something back. A lot of times I don't know how I'm going to give it. They talk about the 11 steps. I don't know what you want me to do, God, but ask me. I'm going to try. I try to move towards the resistance today because I find when I get on the other side, I benefit. See, I can't give nothing with my hands closed, y'all. But when I give it, my hands is open. Guess what? I'm going to get to because I keep my hands open. Somebody ain't listening in there. See, all that stuff sounds like cliches, but I'm talking about for real. I'm talking about for real getting out of my way on a daily basis, and it's like in a 10th step where it says we develop a groove. You know how you, when you go to saw something in the beginning, the saw be buckling and shit, but then all of a sudden you get a groove. Yeah, you get a groove at looking at yourself. Not at night, but through the day. My life done become a prayer, y'all. I'm talking about treating work as worship. And the benefits derived far exceed my pay. That's the kind of stuff my sponsor taught me. And he would make me say, I said, Tom, talk to me like I'm a baby. And he said, well, son, you don't want to piss in the water you got to wash your face with. What? Makes sense today. I don't want to ruin a good thing, y'all. And it's truly a good thing. If you're new in this program, I double dare you to try it. I don't have the words, I don't have the intelligence to describe to you what it's like on this side. But I promise you that one promise, if you do what we do, you'll get so much more than you could have ever imagined. I'm Addict named Walson. That's my story. I'm sticking with it. Thank you.